This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on September 1st. An article in the Washington Post last month explores the close working relationships between prosecutors and police. Researchers found that when a new district attorney takes office, police kill fewer people, and the percentages are similar irrespective of the victim's race, even though people of color are far more likely to be victims of police brutality. Nevertheless, one factor appears to have an outsized influence. Whether the political race for district attorney was seriously contested or not. Across all districts, the overall reduction in police killings was 17%, 1-7, after a new DA took office. However, for districts where the election was close, the reduction in police killings was 40%, 4-0. Upon analyzing their data further, the researchers state that after a new district attorney takes office, we found no changes in property crime, violent crime, or arrests. This suggests that when officers want to, they can de-escalate situations that might have otherwise turned deadly, and aren't simply avoiding those situations altogether. Nor do we see an increase in assaults on or deaths of police officers. They emphasize their interpretation, summarizing that officers can de-escalate situations without either refraining from policing or risking greater harm themselves. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Chris Harris, community activist, law enforcement data analyst, advocate for homeless persons, and longtime volunteer for Co-op Community Radio. We're also joined by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Chris, when we last communicated a few days ago, you were down at the ledge dealing with bail reform. What's happening there?
Well, much like most things at the Texas legislature in 2021, it wasn't good. On Monday night, they ended up passing bail bill. They are calling bail reform, but is nothing of the sort. You know, ultimately, it's a giveaway to the bail industry that's going to prevent a lot of folks from being able to access pretrial freedom, meaning freedom before they've been convicted of any crime, without paying. And it'll mean that folks that have money can pay their way out of jail via a bail bond. And those that can't, more of those that can't, will have to stay in. And many of those folks will plead guilty to things they maybe didn't do or didn't do exactly what they're accused of doing because of that. So like many other things at the ledge, you know, there's obviously some constitutional questions with the bill. And so, you know, this is another one that seems destined for the courts. And we'll see what, if any, relief we can get there.
We've been talking about this for years now. I think we did at least one, maybe two shows with Amanda Woog about this. We get our hopes up and then maybe it is crazy to just even hope that there's some shred of humanity or reason in all of this. But there was a constitutional amendment that was potential in this as well.
Yeah, that's right. So the Texas State Constitution requires that in almost every circumstance, judges offer some way to access pretrial freedom, to get out of jail before you've been convicted of a crime. And typically that means via a bond. There are a few exceptions where they don't have to offer bond. Obviously, in like clear cases of someone who, you know, has done something extremely dangerous and represents a big danger. And this constitutional amendment would have opened up more ways for judges to keep people in jail pretrial with no avenue for release, meaning they wouldn't even be able to pay off a bond to get out. And so luckily, this effort was defeated. There's a higher threshold at the legislature for passing constitutional amendments, and even those still have to come through the voters. But luckily, because of that higher threshold, they didn't have the votes to get it through.
Well, a small victory, but we'll take whatever we can get, I guess. So we last spoke with you before the May 1st referendum, and at that time, you were working on homeless issues. We'll get into that in a minute. Between that and what you've been doing at the legislature, what else have you been working on?
You know, good question. You know, with my current, though soon to be passed organization, Texas Appleseed, we also are very focused on relieving the burden that the criminal legal system often places on people via their suspensions or holds on people's driver's licenses. Often, if people are unable to afford, you know, a fine or a fee through the system, there's different avenues and programs that enable the courts to say that people can't drive anymore. And what often this ends up doing is just further burdening those who are unable to pay. So the poorest in our community who can't pay a fine or a fee, then lose their access to drive legally. Then if they're ever pulled over again, now are subject to more tickets and even arrest for driving with a suspended or an invalid license. And then that adds more fines and fees onto their total. So what we see is a lot of folks get trapped in this cycle of jail and escalating debt that they won't get out of without help for years. And yeah, so there's a program called Omnibase that a lot of courts around the state use to put holds on people's licenses such that they can't renew them in this circumstance. And so we've been working along with our partners, the Texas Fair Defense Project, to get local governments to pull out of this program and to stop using this tool on people who are too poor to pay.
Let's just pile on poor people then, right? Let's change our focus a little. Probably going to speak about APD most of the evening. Last Friday afternoon, there was some breaking news about Officer Christopher Taylor. Unprecedented in Austin history, two indictments for first degree murder. What's the community reaction to this?
Well, far be it from me to speak for the entirety of the community, but you know, obviously this is a really big change from not only Austin's history, but really how district attorneys in most of the country have pursued cases of police violence through the courts. And so, you know, I think there is, on one hand, you know, a lot of appreciation for DA Garza living up to, you know, his campaign promises to treat police violence seriously. You know, and I think while, you know, many of us are not super hopeful about necessarily, you know, how things go once this goes to trial, or even necessarily whether or not this creates a deterrent, if the potential for prosecution creates a deterrent to police violence, we will find out the answer in Austin, Texas, given what the district attorney here is doing. Because, you know, unlike other places where we've seen a lot of community pressure build, and then that's the only time that a district attorney will act on police violence, we're seeing him do this as a matter of course, such that there's a real difference. If, again, if there is any deterrent effect to prosecution on police violence, I think Austin, Texas is going to find out because of DA Garza.
You know, I was heartened at least by some news out of Denver also.
You're talking about Elijah McClain?
Exactly.
Definitely. Yes. Elijah McClain, the young boy who was injected with ketamine and died. Right. Yes, there was a lot of people were assuming that nothing was going to come out of that case, given the length of time that it had been. But so it was surprising to see that announced, as well as against the medics on the scene that actually did the injections. So, again, a very interesting case to see. I think an important distinction, you know, cases like George Floyd, cases like Elijah McClain, where you see an extreme local, statewide, even national attention to the cases. Oftentimes, those are the times, if any, when you're going to see an indictment come down, a district attorney feel forced to act. Obviously, the Mike Ramos case here had that level of engagement. Unfortunately, the Maurice DeSilva case, the one that Christopher Taylor was just indicted for, did not. And yet we still see an indictment come down. So, again, I think there's a real difference in what DA Garza is doing here. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not Travis County juries will agree with the grand jury and his department's assessment that these need to be criminally prosecuted.
We had Austin Sanders on last week, who covered the story for the Austin Chronicle. And he quoted the lawyers for the officers as stating that there now appears to be a war between the DA and the Austin Police Association. Would that be your characterization?
Yeah, I think that's fair. What, you know, I think we've started to see is that the, for lack of a better term, propaganda machine of the Austin Police Association turn against the district attorney, and not just as it relates to, you know, his pursuit of prosecutions for police violence, really trying to pin him for any sort of perceived issues with safety in the community, trying to point to his policies as some sort of issue to their work and to the public safety. And I think it's completely untrue and definitely based on, first and foremost, their extreme opposition to his criminal prosecutions of their membership for police violence, in addition to their political disagreements with some of his policies. But definitely, and I think we're seeing it as well with the department at large, not just the police association that represents the individual officers, but with the city police department. You know, we've had DA Garza and the county attorney, Delia Garza, write a letter to the city manager, to the interim police chief Chacon, you know, saying, hey, your officers are not investigating the crimes that I'm trying to prosecute. And what is going on? Why are they not doing that? And for many of us who've seen this tactic both here in Austin and elsewhere around the country, it really smacks of these soft strikes that police will do, seemingly to try to show their importance and to get their way, to gum up the works of the system or simply deny or refuse service to people in the community and then point the finger at someone else as being the cause of it, particularly someone who's, again, doing something that they disagree with politically. So, you know, I think there's a definite breakdown as it relates to communication there. And specifically, the city, to my knowledge, still has not responded to that letter, which is really baffling to me. I don't understand how the interim police chief, the city manager, can think that the status quo is in any way something that can be lived with for any period of time and doesn't demand response. So I think there's a big question mark over the city manager and the police chief right now in terms of, you know, what are they doing and are they responding in any way to these accusations, these very serious accusations?
Well, on top of these indictments, Jim and I did a show a few weeks ago with Farrah Muscadin, and in her annual report, there were over 300 complaints stemming from the BLM protests from a year ago. Talking to Austin Sanders, it sounds like there may be more indictments stemming from all that. Have you picked that up at all?
I don't know about that. You know, I think it's kind of unfathomable thing that's come up is that there have been no internal discipline stemming from the protests. When so many of us who engaged with either the protests or city council last summer We heard multiple, many, many hour meetings where hundreds of people called in. Many of them had been at the protest, witnessed firsthand, or were victims firsthand of police violence, at a protest against police violence. And yet nothing seemingly has been done internally about those cases as far as any sort of discipline. Obviously, some of those incidents, the boy Ayala who was shot, who wasn't even participating in the protest, and some others where we've seen video, it seems pretty stark that something wrong occurred, that people were hurt unjustly. So for there to have been no discipline coming from the department in the form of suspensions or terminations or anything really speaks to just a complete abdication of any sort of duty to hold their people accountable. And again, you know, I think there's some question about the level of deterrent that, you know, different forms of punishment will have on police violence. But clearly, if nothing occurs after someone does something wrong, there's literally no mention of it, then that's a clear signal that behavior was okay. And I don't think many people in Austin, having seen what happened at those protests, would agree with that.
Bob, let me back up a minute about the monitor situation. I think it's interesting that there's not the kind of police reaction against the monitor as there is against the DA. And I wonder what that means in terms of the effectiveness of the monitor, number one. And number two, where is the monitor when we'd not seen any movement on the suppression of demonstrations last year?
By monitor, you mean OPO, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are good questions. I am aware of a lot of backroom machinations on the part of the police association in attempts to undermine the OPO throughout its history, and particularly in recent years. And I think that with negotiations on a new police contract between the police association and the city coming up soon, I would not be surprised if the open war on the Office of Police Oversight doesn't begin shortly or in conjunction with those negotiations. So we'll see, but I fully expect them to attempt to roll back many of the gains that were made in the last contract. And that includes some of the powers that the Office of Police Oversight was granted, the newer powers. So that said, you raise a great point. Obviously, the new powers that the office has have not helped lead to more consistent discipline being rendered in cases of clear, open, even public police violence. And so if anything, where we need to see in the next contract is a strengthened Office of Police Oversight. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to galvanize the community in that same way as was done back in 2017.
Yeah, you know, I think that these machinations by the police have gone on forever, of course, you know, at the fight against the DAs. And I think that what Garza has done is good in surfacing that and making it public and refusing to kowtow to the police. It seems to me that this is sort of where we're going to have to get with the monitor too, so that it gets to be very clear to the public what's going on in terms of this struggle. The police have long had their way in criminal prosecutions, no matter what the DAs have said over the years.
Right.
And Garza is really the first one who's challenged that. Also, you know, as I listen to you talk, Chris, too, this reflects on the current leadership in the police department pretty dramatically, I think, particularly given that we're looking at hiring permanently the current acting chief.
Yeah, no question. I know you wanted to get into that in a minute, but, you know, I think it's important for community to know that for a long time, or often, is an agreement with the chief of police and the district attorney about incidents involving police officers, right? So if an incident rises to the level of potential criminal activity, then, you know, what we've seen both here in Austin as well as in a lot of places around the country is that the police won't do anything as it relates to any sort of internal discipline. Have they broached our internal departmental policies? Do they need to be written up or suspended or fired? They'll wait to see what happens with the courts. even though we understand the courts take much, much longer, right? They can take years to adjudicate these cases, whereas most police departments are required to fully investigate and come to a judgment in, you know, under 6 months. But that situation doesn't exist here in Austin anymore. There was very clear communication from the district attorney that the police department can move forward with any sort of internal investigations and discipline that it needs to, and it will do its work over here in just the same way. Nonetheless, the police department has refused to do anything. And so they really can't say that it's because of these pending criminal prosecutions. It seems entirely just, again, that they've abdicated any duty to hold their own people accountable for a breach of their own internal policies. And obviously, like, a major breach of community trust and that, you know, people entrusted to protect and serve the community are committed unjust harm and violence against them.
Are you involved in the interviewing of the new chief candidates?
I have not been intimately involved. No, I did watch the forums and I attended one of the in-person forums with the candidates a couple weeks back, though.
Anything you want to share about them?
Goodness. Well, I think that, you know, obviously we brought up a lot of issues with the current interim chief, Chacon, in that, one, the lack of response to the current district attorney and county attorney about the behavior of some of the people that are supposed to be investigating criminal activity in the community are not doing that. We've also talked about how, you know, obviously they haven't pursued any sort of discipline, apparently, as it relates to police activity during the protests last year. To me, these are major red flags, you know, and I say all that, and I also say that Interim Chief Chacon probably, you know, understands this community largely, I'm sure, by virtue of having been here for a long time, and probably says the things that people like me and a lot of other folks in this community want to hear. The other candidates, and I'll say just in general, none of the three candidates really, though, even still, seem to understand fully the concept behind reimagining public safety, as shown by the task force that was commissioned following the protests last year and the report that was put out at the beginning of this summer. They, you know, I think uniformly equate reimagining public safety with redoing the police training academy, which is a process that's undergoing. And I think that redoing the police training is important, of course, but that's not what reimagining public safety is. Reimagining public safety is a much higher level examination of what all actually contributes to keeping people in our community safe and ensuring that we're prioritizing our resources towards those exact forms of support and services. And so obviously where that includes police, but we're trying to broaden it. We look at situation like with our current pandemic, we've had over 1,000 people die in our community in the last year and a half from COVID. There was International Overdose Awareness Day yesterday. Last year in 2020, over 500 people died of overdoses in our community. These are just as much a part of public safety as how many crimes are committed, how many murders are committed. And we need to be ensuring that we're protecting people's lives and health across all of these vectors to maximize the health and safety of our community. But for the current candidates, they're really focused purely on policing still. There's no willingness to examine broader city budgets to determine whether or not our resources are flowing to maximize the health and safety of community members. They see only their role in the process. And to me, that's really unfortunate. And I think there was an opportunity with this candidate to get someone who understood that vision and who would embrace it. And unfortunately, that's not what we see here.
Who's responsible for coming up with that final slate?
Well, there was a review panel that was put together. I can't tell you who all was part of that. But, you know, ultimately, I think that this choice rests with, to your question, ultimately, the city manager is the one who makes this decision. I think it's important to bring up one other thing as it relates to this topic, which is that the city of Austin promoted internally the last police chief, right? So police chief Brian Manley had been an assistant chief, then was the interim chief, and then was promoted to the full-time role. Last summer, there was a call to fire police chief Manley, and there was even a vote of no confidence taken by the city council. At which point it was determined that state law actually prevents a city from firing a police chief who was promoted internally. The only thing that you can do is demote them. And so now we are here again, where one of our three finalists is an internal candidate. And it strikes me as ludicrous that they would even consider putting themselves back in the position of literally not being able to fire the police chief. Because you never know what's going to happen and what actions are people going to take. So it seems as though there might be some ways that they can address that. They could put something in a contract, you know, somewhere that would get around it. But to me, if that's not addressed, you know, in addition to all the other issues I mentioned, it's just disqualifying.
Well, let's move to Save Austin Now. This is painful, no matter which way we slice this. You know, going back, maybe without reliving all the pain, just to remind people about Prop B back on May 1st, maybe tell us a little about the vote and the enforcement plan that happened for the months that followed, and maybe bring us up to where we stand today.
Yeah, I'll do my best. Yes. So Prop B was the ballot measure that was up in the city of Austin in May of this year that proposed to reinstate fully three ordinances which had been curtailed 2 years prior. And the three ordinances collectively criminalized the status of homelessness in Austin by virtue of specifically banning sleeping outdoors with any of your possessions with you, sitting or lying down in the downtown region. And Prop B actually expanded that to campus. And then finally, asking for help, flying a sign, panhandling, whatever you want to call it, during certain hours of the day, as well as around certain types of infrastructure. And so we had helped curtail these ordinances originally because we heard directly from people who were experiencing homelessness how these negatively impacted them. And obviously, we saw that it wasn't really helping with homelessness. And then we fought this ballot measure to bring those ordinances back for the same reasons. And unfortunately, as pretty much everyone knows, I'm sure, it did pass 57% to 43% in May.
Our guest this evening is Chris Harris, community activist, especially in matters of public safety. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. And don't forget that Co-op's fall membership drive starts next week. More information at koop.org. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on September 1st. Our guest this evening is Chris Harris, community activist and law enforcement data analyst. Let's pick up where we left off. Chris is talking about the situation for homeless persons since the May 1st referendum.
Since then, the city has undertaken what they've called a phased approach to implementation, meaning that first there was initial outreach to a lot of folks that are unhoused, to let them know that this was coming and that soon that they would be forced to leave the locations where they're at. Secondarily, they started to move people, particularly from places that they deemed dangerous to their safety, with threat of ticket or arrest. And then the third phase was the actual move everybody who's in any sort of basically visible spot, again, with the threat of ticket or arrest. And that started on August 11th. Now, what we've seen primarily, and this is from people I've talked to that are experiencing homelessness and those that work with them, is that they've mostly undertaken this through kind of a series of increasingly aggressive sweeps, which is a normal process that, you know, that they continue to do even when the ordinances were curtailed, where they would go to the camps and they would throw stuff away. Now, how much stuff they threw away, and if they threw away people's important possessions and their actual homes, the tents they lived in, would depend on who was doing it, depend on a number of factors, it would seem, some of which were opaque to us. But now, you know, often with police in tow, these sweeps are throwing more and more things away and people's whole tents and often all the possessions inside of those tents, including their important personal documents and all that. Thus far, though, what we haven't seen is a lot of tickets or citations or arrests being made, though there have been a few. And so what we also are seeing now is Save Austin Now, unhappy with the pace of the displacement of unhoused people, suing the city because they want them to do it faster and more harshly. And it's incredibly sad and unfortunate. You know, basically when they're pushing people from an underpass or a park, they don't have another place for them to go. They're not pointing them to a shelter bed that's available or a camp that's legal. They're simply taking their things and telling them to go away. But they don't have anywhere else to go most of the time. So as we predicted, it's a really unfortunate situation that's causing a lot of pain and grief for people who are dealing with the most extreme form of poverty in our community. It saddens me greatly to see it happening.
Well, Save Austin Now is clearly emboldened by their victory back in May. And so now we've got Save Austin Now 2.0 with Proposition A going to be on the ballot this November. Could you tell us what that's about and where that came from?
Well, first, it's real important to understand Save Austin Now. The primary leaders of the group are the Travis County Republican Party. You know, that's where their headquarters are. That's what they're run out of. Save Austin Now, the organization. Their other kind of primary pillar of the group is the Austin Police Association, who we've been talking about quite a bit, the organization that represents individual officers in the Austin Police Department. And so, yes, embolden is the right word. So they've gone forward now to put another item on a ballot, another low turnout ballot, this time November of this year, so November 2nd. There might be a state constitutional amendment or something. I don't know if there'll be any other items on the ballot, to be honest. So if people show up, it'll be about this. But the idea behind it is that they want to force Austin to immediately hire a lot more police officers. The long and short of it is that it's a dangerous, fiscally irresponsible measure that would force the city to cut a lot of essential services and probably raise taxes as well in order to meet the demands of this proposition.
And then the city actually came up with the wording for the ballot, and the wording actually includes estimated costs for this thing. So there's a lawsuit over that, I understand.
That's right. So, you know, technically, it is not allowed to put items on a ballot through a petition process that force a city to spend resources. I couldn't put a ballot measure up that says spend $200 million on this. But Save Austin Now has basically found an end around this law by saying we're going to pass an ordinance that says you have to have a certain ratio of police to civilians that live in the city. And then also require that they get at least 35% of their time to not be responding to 911 calls. You know, ultimately, it doesn't say anything about money in the ballot. But obviously, this is going to have extreme costs. So the city ran the numbers and they had an estimate. High end of that estimate is $120 million per year. And it would basically force the city again to hire about 680 more police officers right away and then continually to add as the city's population grew. And so they didn't want to put the cost in there. This was an end run around the law that says you can't make a city spend money. And so the city said, well, we should put the cost in there so people understand that this does come with a cost. And so they're basically suing the city to keep the people less informed about what this ballot measure does, because they know that people will have a sticker shock. They understand that $600 million over the next 5 years is totally undoable to just slide into a city budget. And that it would mean cuts to parks, to our emergency medical system, to our fire department, to our libraries, to heck, it could mean trash pickup. Who knows? Like every service would be on the chopping block when you're talking about adding that much money to a budget overnight with no increased revenue coming in. It's completely unfunded. So it's a dangerous measure. And, you know, of course, I think another important point is that it's based on this ill-conceived notion that the more the merrier as it relates to police. The more police that you have, the safer that you'll be, and there's no downsides. And the reality is that many cities used to use this, you know, metrics as it relates to population to determine how many police they're supposed to have. Those metrics have been proven to be completely arbitrary. We've seen across the country, different cities with different size forces have very different responses and very different changes in, you know, what's deemed crime rates. So it's completely arbitrary, and it's very much designed to increase the power both of Save Austin Now as an entity, as well as the Austin Police Association. Because again, every new officer, there's a very high likelihood they'll be a member of APA and be paying dues to the organization and all that.
Backing up a little, you're mentioning the APD budget, and even without Save Austin Now 2.0, we watched the police budget magically get restored to its level of 2 years ago, thanks to HB 1900.
The same wonderful legislature that brought you a six-week abortion ban, open carry, no permit, you know, gun ownership, and never expanding Medicaid, and a whole host of other atrocities, brings you never-ending increases in police budgets. So yeah, HB 1900 requires that a city never spend less than the previous, well, it's a two-year look back, but previous year's police budgets. Note that it only applies to the 11 largest cities in the state. So, you know, magically, it doesn't apply to any other communities, but those 11 biggest cities now are required to raise their police budget every year. And if they don't, face a series of very, very substantial consequences that would really even further sort of harm their ability to govern themselves and collect enough revenue. It would force them to de-annex parts of the city. There's a provision specifically attacking Austin that would harm public utilities. You know, a whole host of basically untenable consequences that no city would rightfully take on. So they crafted it well to ensure compliance. Most of the cuts from the police budget the year prior were in pulling out the 911 call center from the police department and pulling out the forensics lab from the police department. Those two entities have just been put back into APD. So the National Academy of Sciences has been recommending independent forensics labs going back at least to 2009. And the state law basically reversed the city's decision to follow that guidance. And we know from the public safety departments that there's a lot of challenges with, you know, having a specific entity over the 911 call center and dispatch. And so, you know, I think there was a lot of promising opportunities in pulling it out of APD, which unfortunately now will be difficult to implement. So yeah, you know, a really short-sighted and backwards law from an entity, the Texas Ledge, that specializes in.
Before, you talked a little about reimagining public safety. Is that the end of that initiative with these huge police budgets again, or is there some way that that can go forward now, or what's your take on that?
It's not the end. It's definitely a blow. Because ultimately, the police department comprises, you know, 40%+ of the general fund of our city. And it's a similar percentage in most other big cities. And so when you're talking about opportunities to reallocate resources to better protect health and safety, the police department represents the biggest opportunity for that. That said, this is a wealthy city, and the city does have a lot of resources at its disposal, not $120 million per year to add police officers wealthy, but definitely enough to do a lot of the things that Reimagine Public Safety Task Force recommended. And I definitely want to just give a big shout out to all the task force members, particularly the folks that helped lead us, Brian Oaks, the city, Paolo Rojas with Communities of Color United, and all the community people that participated in that process, poured their hearts and souls into rethinking, you know, how they would be better served and protected by our city. There were a lot of things in there. We're talking about community health hubs, talking about, you know, basic income and a whole host of other programs, big and small, that would contribute to, you know, more health and safety in our communities, and particularly in our poorest communities and those that have been most negatively impacted by policing. And so there are still very much opportunities for the city to fund some of those things, as well as to look at, you know, responding to mental health calls and other forms of 911 calls differently. You know, unfortunately, even if they reallocate duties from the police, they're forced to spend the same amount of money on police. That doesn't mean they shouldn't still look at if they can, if someone better can be sent to an incident, to respond to an incident, that should still happen, no matter, you know, where the money actually comes from.
We did a show with Paola and Brian, and I was very much moved by the scope and the depth of whole effort. I sure hope that significant portions of that survive and that it doesn't get thrown under the bus here. We've just got a few minutes left. Maybe a few comments about the police academy. They resumed the class in June. Was that premature or was it time for that? But even with that happening, there was some recent flack about the curriculum review going awry. What are your thoughts about the police academy?
Yeah, I can't claim to be the most informed about it, but I share the sentiments of the Reimagine Public Safety Task Force that really asked the city not to move forward with that at that time. The case for that has only become stronger since the task force made that recommendation. We've learned that they're right, that they hadn't really kicked off a lot of the community review process. In fact, did so in the immediately before they started the class, which of course means that there, you know, much of the curriculum had yet to be reviewed before being taught. We've subsequently found out that some of the curriculum included history lessons that literally were developed by the John Birch Society.
Whoa.
You know, some of your listeners might know as a, yeah, an arch sort of right-wing group founded, you know, back in the 60s. So, you know, lots of problems continue to be unearthed with that. And I think it's unfortunate that another class of cadets that will soon be patrolling our streets are learning things again that we know are, you know, counter to the values of our city.
Jeez. And then I just read a piece about a week ago in the Chronicle about this guidance advisory program. It's used for monitoring excessive force and other police misconduct. It didn't paint a very good picture of the current state of that program.
One thing I will say is there's a growing understanding of police and characterization of police that I think is accurate of them as violence workers. We can update the curriculum. We can try to change what's being taught out there. But ultimately, what the police are for is the threat or the use of force, of violence in some form. And that's what they're mostly going to be trained in. And that's what they're mostly there to provide. And so it's really difficult, if not impossible, to get individuals. That's what their primary purpose is. That's what their primary goal is. That's what most of the equipment on their uniform is for, to act in substantively different ways and to avoid using those tools and that training. And so, again, I think it's just another one of the reasons why so many of us are so focused on really trying to understand every situation where other types of people with other types of skills and other types of relationships can be deployed to situations that we're currently deploying police to, so that we can avoid, whenever possible, any sort of unnecessary violence.
Good work, Chris. Nice contribution to the community you're giving us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. Really means a lot coming from you. Appreciate that.
Chris, you're just a treasure trove of knowledge when it comes to public safety here. I think I speak for a lot of people in the community in expressing my own gratitude for all that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate your show and the opportunity to address your listeners and all you're doing, you and Jim, to, you know, give voice to a lot of these issues. So thank you.
All the best to you, Chris.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, September 3rd, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us. Austin is a staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, covers city council, APD, homelessness, and a whole bunch of other issues. How you doing today, Austin?
I'm hanging in there. It's been a tough week.
Boy, you can say that again, you know?
Yeah. The other night, looking at some news on Twitter and reading about the wildfires in California, the hurricane in the southeast and power disasters that are stemming from that, the flooding in New York City. And that was all on the day that the 6-week abortion ban in Texas went into effect. So it was just like a lot of grim news all hitting at once.
Well, at least there were some interesting developments at City Council yesterday.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a good news story. Council approved a contract with a local nonprofit called Building Promise USA. And their mission is to help people who are exiting the prison system reintegrate into society. Individuals who are formerly incarcerated faced a number of institutional barriers in obtaining housing, jobs, transportation, government assistance. The stigma of a prison sentence doesn't go away when someone leaves the penitentiary. This nonprofit aims to help people navigate the systems of support that are available in the Travis County community to make that transition smoother and really help them achieve their individual goals and aspirations. So this was a 12-month contract for $200,000. Not a huge amount, but the goal is to kind of set up a one-stop shop through this nonprofit where someone can go and just get connected with other organizations, other services, again, to kind of help that transition. And another thing that's notable about this contract is it is one of the items that has been funded through council's budget last year, which reallocated some funding away from the Austin Police Department and kind of set it aside for various uses. And this was an amendment put forth by Mayor Pro Tem Natasha Harper Madison to reserve $400,000 for these reentry type organizations and programs. So I believe this is the first we're seeing of that funding actually being put to use, hoping that this nonprofit can use it to help members of our community who are trying to reintegrate into society after serving a prison sentence.
Well, that is encouraging. As you point out, the amount is not overwhelming, especially when compared with a civil suit that they just settled. Tell us about that.
Yeah, right. So council also approved a $2.25 million settlement in a civil lawsuit that was filed by the parents of a 20-year-old Hispanic man named Jason Roque. He was shot and killed in 2017 by an APD officer, James Harville. A 911 call came in on May 20th, 2017. Jason Roque's mother had called because he was threatening to kill himself. He had a BB gun that looked like a firearm. He had it pointed at his head when the officers arrived. And again, you know, this is another case where the mother calling the 911 operator said he has what looks like a firearm, but it's a BB gun, to kind of warn the officers. It's unclear how much of that was communicated to the officers who responded. But when they got there, Jason kind of made like a slight movement. And then Officer Harville responded by firing at him. As he fell to the ground, he shot him two more times. He died from those gunshot wounds. The former Travis County District Attorney, Margaret Moore, declined to seek criminal charges against Harper. And in fact, he was cleared of wrongdoing by APD's Internal Affairs Division. Council can always vote to settle a lawsuit in these cases. And in fact, of course, that's what they did here. It was a 10-1 vote. Council member Mackenzie Kelly was the only member to vote against the settlement. And she told us it was because the DA did not press criminal charges and the officer was cleared of wrongdoing by the Internal Affairs Division. So she, you know, decided to vote against the settlement. Of note as well, if listeners had heard you and I talk about the cost of police violence on a previous show, this is the largest settlement that the city has paid to a victim's family since 2016, when David Joseph's mother, Ketty Sully, was paid $3.25 million. So it's a notable settlement. Nothing can replace loss of life here, but it's a reflection of the damage done to this family by the actions of this APD officer.
You know, last week we talked about those indictments, and I think what may have gotten lost a little bit is that the parents of Maurice De Silva also have initiated a civil suit, right?
Yeah, that's right. Brenda Ramos, the mother of Michael Ramos, has filed a lawsuit against the city. It'll be interesting to see how those lawsuits play out, given the circumstances in each are not that different from this 2017 case, which again resulted in a $2.25 million settlement. So I'll be watching those closely.
So the De Silva and Brenda Ramos, there are multiple civil suits outstanding, it sounds like. On top of all that, they had to deal with the language for Prop A. What turn has that taken?
We had talked about this before, and council, when they adopted ballot language for the Save Austin Now police staffing initiative, it'll appear on the ballot as Proposition A. Council basically written their own language, including the estimated cost of these initiatives, which was left out of the petition caption, which is written by Save Austin Now, and it appears on the petition that they're asking people to sign. A lawsuit was filed on behalf of Save Austin Now with the Supreme Court of Texas. And earlier this week, they ruled that the city council would have to rewrite that ballot language. Although, importantly, they agreed with council that the estimated cost should be included because leaving that off would mislead voters. So that estimated, which again is about on the low end, $271 million over 5 years. And on the high end, $598 million over 5 years. So that will still be included. Other than that, the language that council wrote is just thrown out. And instead, the petition caption will be used. Again, that was written by Save Austin Now.
Well, it sounds like it wasn't a total loss for the city council anyway, if they can at least get the costs in there.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where both, you know, Mayor Steve Adler and Save Austin Now, following the ruling, each issued statements saying, hey, we won, right? So it was kind of a split victory for the both of them.
Well, finally, there's been a lot of talk about I-35 improvements, and this has taken a turn with some neighborhoods. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's really growing into a community-wide push against plans by the Texas Department of Transportation to widen I-35. The portion of the project we're talking about is in central Austin on the northern end. It's near US 290 East, the Manor Expressway. And on the southern end, US 290 West, which is Ben White Boulevard, the plan is to add two managed lanes going north and south. Basically, what that means is the traffic on those lanes would be reserved for high occupancy vehicles, so carpoolers, maybe buses, other kinds of transit vehicles. Yeah, there's been some kind of grassroots opposition to this plan, really pushing back on plans to widen the highway, which would require demolishing around 150 properties, one of which I should note is the Austin Chronicle headquarters. We're right there on about 40th Street fronting I-35. So the owner of the building would either need to sell the property to the government or take it through eminent domain. Really, we could spend a whole show talking about the highway expansion of the 1950s was a big part of quote unquote urban renewal, which was really a tool of government segregation, tore through mostly black and brown communities to build the highways that we use every day. So a lot of the opposition is rooted in that history, not wanting to repeat it. And really the other end of it is just promoting mass transit over single occupancy vehicle traffic, which is the primary use on highways. As we've seen in the state, most notably in Houston, where highways have been widened, they don't really solve for traffic congestion. A highway in the Katy area was widened. It's one of the biggest in Texas. It may be the biggest in Texas. And almost immediately, the same congestion returned. And so Mayor Pro Tem Harper Madison kind of asked about this at a work session that council held. She basically said, if this project is completed, how long until it's just as congested as the existing I-35? And Tucker Ferguson, who is a district engineer at TxDOT overseeing the Austin area, he said, you know, I'm quoting here, we're not pretending to say that the expansion we're proposing is building our way out of congestion. So there's acknowledgement right there that it will not solve traffic congestion. What it will do, Ferguson says, is it will help move more people across the highway because of the high occupancy requirements on the two managed lanes. Transit advocates really vigorously push back on that idea and say there are much more cost-effective ways of moving more people than vehicles through mass transit. And of course, we're in the very early stages of building out two light rail lines, a massive expansion of our bus system as a part of Project Connect. And so climate activists would really much rather see investments in those areas rather than widening a freeway.
Well, there'll be plenty more to say about that story, I'm sure. Well, thank you so much for the council wrap up as always, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Bob.
Up next here on coop.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel is Youth Spin in its new slot. Stay tuned. And that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone.